All right. Hello, everyone. Okay, shall we carry on? Are you ready? So let's just quickly have a look at the reinforcements. Yeah, sada. It's a nice color for the coffee thing, you know, black, is this right? I like that. So let's carry on. So we're going to have a look at the result of the practice, right? So you have like the right view at the beginning, then you have all the practice going on, and then we have the result. That's what we're looking at now. I'm going to look at this fairly quickly because it's not really the main thing I want to focus on. It's just part of the suttas. So I thought I might as well go through it quickly. So again, I just read this before, the sage, yeah, this is here, the Muni, you can see the word over here for sage, one of the important words for Muni, for sage. Another one is Rishi or Isi, it also means sage. There's a number of words for sage in the suttas. So never strays from the truth. The Brahman stands firm on the shore. The word Brahman here is like the God, right? In the Hindu religion or the Brahmanical religion, Brahman is the supreme God of the Hindus. It's like the underlying kind of reality of existence. In Buddhism, that word is used to mean the highest. Yeah, it means like the person who is an arahant, who is fully awakened. They are called the Brahman. So the Buddha takes the words of ancient India, of the Brahmanical tradition, and he uses them in new ways to have give them new meanings. So Brahman, instead of just being either here it doesn't mean that. Here it means Brahmana. Here it means the people of the highest caste, the priestly caste. So the Buddha redefines, instead of being a priestly caste, and therefore you are the highest, the Buddha says you are the highest because you are an arahant. So he calls the arahants Brahmanas to make them the highest. So he redefines these terms. Having given up everything, they are said to be at peace. Yeah, so to really be at peace, you have to give up everything. This is what you do as a arahant. Giving up, what does it mean to give up? Give up does not mean you reject everything. Giving up just means that you give up attachment and craving for everything. That is the idea of giving up here. All craving, all attachment is gone. Even to your own life, even to your own five khandhas, even to your own mind, you have no attachment. Then you are santo, you are at peace. You see the word santo down there at the very bottom. One of these beautiful words that is used in the suttas. The santo muni, you see santo there, you see muni there. It is sometimes combined. Santo muni means the sage at peace. We have an Agarika at our monastery who calls himself santo muni. I don't know if he's all that peaceful, but anyway, that's what he calls himself. They have truly known, they are a knowledge master, understanding the teaching, they are independent. They rightly proceed in the world, not coveting anything here. Yeah, you have truly known, you have a true insight, and that is the meaning of knowledge master in the Buddhist teachings. The word Vedagu is also used in the Brahmanical tradition, the Hindu tradition, but there it means you know the Vedas. In other words, you have memorized the Vedas. But in Buddhism, we give it a new meaning. Once again, in the Buddhism, it means that you have insight. So the difference between the Buddhism and the Brahmanical tradition is that in the Brahmanical tradition, knowledge is related to having memorized things, knowledge like school knowledge. In Buddhism, real knowledge has to do with insight, and of course that is much more profound. Understanding the teaching, they are independent. The idea that a true master in Buddhism is an independent person is a very important point, and this is one of the ways you can recognize someone who is very profound and who has very deep meditation and insight. Are they independent or not? Are they able to live the world free of the worries about what other people think? Independence is one of the beautiful results of this practice. If you want to be more independent in your life, and I think we all like to be more independent, One way of doing that is actually to practice the Buddhist path. It makes you more independent. It makes you more your own person, being able to stand your own ground, not being so concerned about what the people think about you. It's a beautiful result of the path. They rightly proceed in the world, right? They live well in the world. They live in the right way, not coveting anything here, not being desirous of anything. You move through the world without leaving a trace because you don't covet anything here. You don't desire anything in the world. You don't bother anyone. There's no arguments to be had with you because there's nothing that you want from the world anymore, except for coffee. No. One who has crossed over sensuality here, the snare in the world so hard to get past, grieves not, nor hopes. They've cut the strings, they are no longer bound. You can see how this idea of sensuality or the sensory world always comes back. And it always comes back as something that's very difficult to deal with, very difficult to overcome. Yeah, and this is, I think, one of the things in the suttas that is one of the recurring themes, as so to speak, in the suttas, that the sensory world is something that we really need to work on the Buddhist practice. I wouldn't overstate it. For monastics, probably more important. But the idea is that if you really want to let go of the lower world and reach something higher, giving up the sensory world is actually a very important part. And it's a very difficult thing to do, because it is so attractive, it is so ensnaring, and it's not easy to give it up. But to get a really peaceful mind, a mind that turns away and turns toward real peace, it is actually going to be a requirement down the path. So this is why it is so emphasized in the suttas. Once you leave sensuality behind, the rest of the path is fairly easy. That is by far the hardest part of the path. Yeah, the snare in the world so hard to get past. Yeah, the snare, it ties you up, makes it really difficult. Once you are past that, you have no grief about what's happened, nor do you have any hopes for the future, because you've given up those things entirely. No strings, and you are no longer bound. What came before, let wither away, and after, let there be nothing. If you don't grasp at the middle, you will live at peace. Yeah, so what came before, you are never worried about it, you never live in the past. Yeah, it's all gone, you just let it wither away and disappear. Sometimes people live in the past in this world, but if you are on the spiritual path, there's no need to live in the past, because you are moving towards more light, more brightness, you're moving towards a better life. That makes it much easier to let go of the past. And after, let there be nothing. You have nothing, no interest in the future, because you're living here and now, doing the best you can possibly do. And that is what matters in your life. You don't grasp at the middle, you don't grasp at what is here right now either. You just go with the flow of things. You float through the world in an easy way, not grasping at the past, the future, or the present. And then you will live at peace. Upasanto, upasamo, another of these beautiful words that basically means peace and stillness in your life. No grasping at anything here. This particular verse is very similar to what you find in the Bhaddhikarata Sutta, famous sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 131, one auspicious night, and it has the same kind of idea. You live or you dwell or you meditate without holding on to the past, without grasping onto the future, and you have insight into the present states as they are. And this is how you kind of have an auspicious night of meditation, if you like. One who has no sense of ownership in the whole realm of name and form does not grieve for that which is not. They suffer no loss in the world. Mamayitang, nothing. You have no mine. Mama means my. So you have no mine. In other words, no ownership. This is mine. Give it to me. You have none of that mine thing. And because you have none of that mine thing in the whole realm of name and form. Well, name and form here, nama rupa, this is everything in our mind and body. This is everything that we can relate to mentally or physically. That's the realm of name and form. So you don't grasp anything anywhere, yeah, in the whole world, including your inner world and the inner things that you normally people are very concerned about. All of that, it becomes irrelevant for you. And because you grasp nothing in any of these realms, there's nothing to grieve. Yeah, because you can never suffer loss in the world. Whatever happens in your life, loss becomes impossible because you don't take anything to be yours. So even if you die, even if you lose your own life, you haven't lost anything because it wasn't your life anyway. And you kind of just shrug your shoulders, okay, should I kill you? Whatever, it's up to you. Yeah, I don't really care. Yeah, do as you see fit. Yeah. Something like that. If you don't think of anything as belonging to yourself or others, not finding anything to be mine, you won't grieve thinking, I don't have it. Yeah, it's more of the same, really. If nothing belongs to you or anyone, nothing is yours, well, you can't think, I don't have it. Yeah, you don't think of things as belonging to you anymore, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. You just kind of move on. You allow things to be. Things belong to nature. Things belong to the world. They belong to impermanence. They're not really the possessions of anyone. It's this idea of borrowing things. Things are borrowed goods. Nothing to hold on to. Nothing to grasp in the whole world. It's hard to understand. Yeah, this is kind of the arahant, remember. And it's just meant there for inspiration, not really for full comprehension. Because as long as you have a sense of self, actually, it is impossible to understand this fully. Yeah. Not bitter, not fawning, unstirred, everywhere even. When asked about one who is unshakable, I declare that that is the benefit. Not bitter, not fawning. Okay, not fawning, not greedy or something, not really holding on to things. Unstirred, this is like the idea of being imperturbable. Sabbadisamo, always even. Yeah, anenjo here is unperturbed, unstirred, always even in the world. And this is kind of one of the beautiful characteristics that we are trying to also build up on the path, the idea of being imperturbable. Because when you are imperturbable, it means that you are able to withstand any shocks in the world. Nothing throws you off course. Nothing is able to upset you. You can deal with anything. And of course, this is what happens also when you practice samadhi in a very deep way. If you get into the jhana states or beyond the jhanas, you are said to be anenja, unshakable, unstirred, imperturbable. And this allows you then to have full insight into the nature of reality, even though that insight can be hard to deal with. Yeah, non-seeing non-self is difficult because our clinging, our attachment to the idea of self is very strong. That's why we need a very powerful mind to do that. The arahant always has that mind, always even. And this is one of the ways you can recognize people who are truly sages. Yeah, you recognize them in their evenness. How even is a person? Are they always kind of stable in the mind, or are they going up and down all the time? The person who can deal with any kind of situation, any kind of difficult situation, that is the person who is most likely to be an arahant. Or they have very good samadhi. How to tell the difference between an arahant and someone who has good samadhi? Very difficult to tell. And you may not be able to tell, so you just I don't know what you do. I guess you can keep on observing them for a long time and see what happens. When asked about one who is unshakable, I declare that is the benefit of being an arahant again. Not fawning. Anamugido, this one here. Fawning is a strange word. I don't know exactly what that's supposed to mean, to be honest with you. But anugido usually means greedy, so it means something like not greedy. But I'm not sure why he has rendered it as fawning. I guess he just had to have some random words. Bhante Sajjato, he likes word. He's a word person. So sometimes he comes up with words that no one else comes up with. Yeah. And so this is the thing here. He told me that his idea of translating the suttas was to make things as simple as possible so everyone can understand. But he obviously has failed. He has failed in this situation. Failed miserably. Oh well. A plant? Formed, I don't think so. Not as far as I know, yeah, but yeah. Yeah.
Google.
Yeah. Oh, that's fawning, of course. Yeah, but that's not the meaning here, is it? Anyway, let's leave it to one side because too difficult to sort out now. Yeah, you fawn for work. Okay, yeah, sure. That's why. Yeah. Anyway, for the unstirred who understand, there is no performance of deeds. Desisting from instigation, they see sanctuary everywhere. Yeah, so if you are unstirred, in other words, you have the evenness of mind, there is no performance of deeds. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that you don't have any, you're no longer creating kamma at this point. You no longer do sankharas. You have no intentions in the world. You don't want to create a future for yourself. Remember that the idea of dependent origination, you have avidya, paccaya, sankhara, sankhara, paccaya, vijnana. The idea is because of ignorance, you do things in the world to create a good future for yourself. Yeah, this is the idea of sankharas. You're always trying to create the future. But the person who is an arahant doesn't create a future anymore. They're not interested in the future. They just live to do the right thing. And in that sense, they don't perform deeds. They don't make kamma anymore. They don't create these kind of things. Desisting from instigation. They also don't instigate anyone else. Or they don't start anything, right? Because they don't start anything, they don't go anywhere, they're not moving towards anything. They see sanctuary wherever they are right now. This is the sanctuary. There's nowhere else to go. There's nowhere to move. There's no future that is interesting. Right now is sanctuary because they've given up attachment to everything in the world. This is the idea of the arahant. A sage doesn't speak of themselves as being among superiors, inferiors, or equals. Peaceful, rid of stinginess, they neither take up nor reject. So it doesn't speak of themselves as being among superiors, inferiors or equals. And again, this is the idea of overcoming conceit, right? There's no sense of superiority, inferiority or equality with other people. People are always changing. How can you measure yourself against someone who is always changing? It doesn't make any sense. When we measure, it's because we think we understand the other person. But we don't understand the other person. We don't know who they are. We don't know what their qualities are. Their qualities are always changing. So how can we measure ourselves against others? How can we feel superior or inferior or equal when there is nothing to measure by? To measure by, you need some quality that is inherent, that is always there. If the qualities are missing, everything is just change. A measurement becomes impossible. Peaceful, rid of stinginess, One of the beautiful qualities of the arahant, they have no stinginess. Vita macharo, machara, or macharo. And when you're rid of stinginess, it means that you are always generous in the world. And this is one of the qualities of the noble ones, that they are very generous. They're always willing to give. If you ask them for a favor, you ask them to give a talk, they ask you to do anything, they will almost always say yes, if they can, unless they are exhausted or they just too many things to do. This is one of the qualities of the sage. Super duper generous. They neither take nor reject. You neither take things up. You neither attach to things. Nor do you let go of things. And the reason why you don't take up or let go is because you have already finished. You have already let go of everything. There's nothing more to reject. There's nothing more to take up. And you're just happy with the way things are in the moment. You float through the world without being touched by the world. This is one of the kind of ideas of the Buddha. All right, that's a very brief going through of those things, the qualities of the Arahanta. Let's leave it at that for this sutta. You can still ask some questions if you wish. So let's just do a 5-minute meditation and we can come back to some questions. Okay. Okay, any questions or comments, or anyone like to say anything over here, Bobby? Yeah.
Venerable Sir, it seems beginning part of the sutta is Buddha is not enlightened yet.
Yeah.
So he had this worry and fear. Whereas in the middle and the later part, he talked about hindrances and arahant, that as if he's already enlightened. So it seems to be like two parts.
It is two parts, I think the point is there's like a shift there. Remember there was a sentence in the middle. You see a sentence in the middle? Let me go back. I'll show you that. It's a little bit of a strange sentence. It seems to be added to make that precise point. If we go up. So here, you see the sentence there in the parentheses? This sentence here. On that topic, the trainings are recited. So before that sentence, it talks about the Buddha to be and about all the problems that he was seeing in the world and how he saw the cause of the problem being the dart, being craving. So that was kind of up to that point. And this is what the Buddha to be saw before the awakening. And then from that sentence onwards, it's like he is shifting from that perspective to talking about the teaching, his own teaching. Talking about the training that needs to be done to overcome those problems. It's as if there is a shift. There's a slightly composite sutta composed of, on the one hand, his biography, on the other hand, the training that he discovers through his awakening. And then the result of that training, which is the arahantship at the very end. So yes, so it's a little bit funny in that way, the sutta, quite right.
Ajahn, in the beginning part of this beautiful sutta, could we say this is a sutta in poetry form, or how is it said in proper name? Because it's not a, is it poetry or how you call it?
It's a gatha form.
Gatha,
yeah.
And how in English? How would it be?
Just call it verse form.
Verse form.
Yes.
In verse form. That's verse what form. That was. The beginning part where he expresses the problem, the line, wanting a home for myself.
Yeah.
I saw nowhere unsettled.
Yeah.
This line reminded me of a line that I remembered in my own language, German, and I tried to translate it into English. It came out something like, no abiding state we have on this earth.
Uh-huh.
No abiding state we have on this earth, or no permanent home we have here.
Yeah.
And this line, I know it's in the Bible.
Okay.
So I want just, it came to my, I want to mention that that all religion are aware of this problem, and they talk about the self.
Yeah.
Basically the self, the same problem.
It is the same problem.
Just to mention
that. Yeah. Because obviously Christian also would be aware that this life has an end, it comes to an end, and everything is impermanent, and then then you're hoping for some permanence somewhere else, and so it's a similar kind of problem. So yes, I think any wise person will be able to see that. If you are wise, it's wisdom that is really the critical thing. The question then is, how good is the solution? And that solution will then vary a little bit from religion to religion. So yes, okay, thank you for that. I must admit, I have been very badly educated. I have no idea about Christianity. I know nothing about Christianity. I grew up in a family that was not religious at all. So I kind of, I know nothing about, I grew up in a so-called Christian culture, but I know nothing about it. And I'm quite happy actually with that, to be honest with you. So, being naughty. Yes.
Hi, Ajahn. I would like to know, based on the sutta, did Buddha mention how long would it take for one to become an arahan?
Wow, that is anything from 1 second to innumerable eons, yeah? Somewhere in between 1 second and innumerable eons. So that really depends on you, right? It depends on what you make of this practice and how inspired you feel and all of these kind of things. So there is no standard time frame. And if you're going to do it in 1 second, you have to be already practiced almost the whole path. Yeah, and then it's because the practice all the way to the end, bang, it can happen very, very quickly. But for most people, it will take time. But the best thing to do is just to feel a sense of urgency. Now is the opportunity. If you don't do it now, when are you going to do it? Probably never. Yeah, there is only now. The only chance you have is now. So please do it now. And it begins with simple things, right? It begins with, we tend to complicate the path too much. We wonder, how should I really practice? But actually, it's very simple. Be kind. Have compassion for the people around you. Don't get angry. There's no reason to get angry in the world, right? People don't know what they're doing. How can you be angry with blind people, with deluded people? It doesn't make any sense. So you just get into those things. Do those very simple things. That is where the path is at. Be generous. Be kind to everyone around you. See what you can do for them. And it kind of, when you open up your heart to the world in this way, life becomes very beautiful and very powerful. That is really what it is about. And these are the simple things. And then if you do those things really, really well and in a very profound way, then meditation becomes so easy. You wonder, how come I never could do meditation before? Now it's so easy. Right? It's like it just happens. And this is one of those things about the suttas where it says that meditation is an automatic process. It's dhammata. It happens according to nature. All you have to do is put in place the causes of the path, and when you put those causes, the root cause into place, the whole process just happens by itself. All you have to do is sit back and you watch the process happen. Yeah, that's what it is all about. But this is kind of the idea of this path. The hard part is to be kind all the time. That's the hard part. It's hard, not because it's difficult to do, but it's hard because it goes against the grain, against our habits, against the way we have been conditioned. That's why it is hard. So we need to recondition ourselves. This is the most difficult thing of the whole path, the reconditioning of the super tanker. We are each one super tanker. Super tanker, because the conditioning is so strong, we have a tremendous momentum in one direction. And to turn that momentum around, it's like turning a super tanker around. It takes kilometers and kilometers and kilometers to come around and come in a different direction. Yes, please.
Ajahn, looking at all the different qualities of the arhan, arhans are not necessarily Buddhists, right? They can be someone, let's say like Mother Teresa, example.
Yeah, you think she was an arhan? Are they Buddhists? Well, it depends what you mean by Buddhist. I mean, they don't wear a label, I'm a Buddhist, you know, that's for sure, huh? But are they Buddhist? Well, they are Buddhist in the sense that they have the same insight as the Buddha. They have the same. Is the Buddha a Buddhist? I don't know. I mean, the Buddha is. He wasn't a Buddhist before he became a Buddhist. But once you have that insight, what does it mean to be a Buddhist? It means to have refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Any arahant will take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha because they know what these things are. That is their refuge. They have become the Dhamma. There are these things. So I would say that they are Buddhists. Even if they don't call themselves Buddhists, they're still Buddhists. Mother Teresa, was she an arahant? I have my doubts, to be honest with you. But I mean, she was many, many good qualities, but it's one thing to have many good qualities, a very different thing to be an arahant. It's a kind of a world transcending thing here. So I would say, if you're an arahant, I would say you're a Buddhist. Yeah. Good news, isn't it? Otherwise, Christian arahants, I don't know about that. Don't we? Please, yeah.
Bhante, I'd like to ask you about the Jataka tales.
Mm.
Both my children, they question the logic of those tales. Because they have been going through Sunday school since young. So they have come to a point, it's just not logical to them.
Yeah.
And it sort of kills their interest in taking this path. But Sunday schools are still, it also comes back to tradition, like you say. Some monks, they do stress on it. And when I pointed it out, it didn't sit lightly on them. So how do I advise my...
I would say no need to go to Sunday school. Yeah. The Sunday school is like a Christian tradition. Yeah, it's kind of taken from Christianity and then it was accepted by Buddhists because Westerners came to Asia and thought, yeah, Christians have, so maybe we should have it as well. And so Buddhists had Sunday school, but we never had Sunday school before. Just a new thing. The thing is that if you, being a Buddhist is actually very demanding. It needs, you need to have an interest in practicing and living well. And a child cannot really decide those things. I would say you only become a Buddhist when you become an adult. Yeah, maybe in your late teens at the earliest. Yeah, maybe mid-teens. But it's very hard to have a child who is a Buddhist. And I think sometimes the best way to make a Buddhist child is to be a good parent. To show kind of through your example the living in a good way. And then when they become old, they think, oh, my mom is a Buddhist. My mom was a great person. She was a most wonderful mum anyone can possibly have. Maybe I should become a Buddhist as well. that is the way, right? You live by example, and suddenly it happens because of the example. But I don't know if sending kids to Sunday school is a good idea, especially if they don't like it. Let them play. Let them enjoy. Let them kind of kick a football around. I don't know what people do here in Malaysia, but whatever it is, and have a good time. Have some time off. There's so much pressure in this world already here. Anyway, I'm just saying random stuff, but anyway, there you are.
But to be that example, right, I find it difficult. My kid did put that to me as well. If you want me to be as what the Buddha is, then why not you become one first? So hence how... Then I told them, let's walk the path together.
Yeah.
Then to my boy, it's like, it's so, like you say, Ajahn, it's so pessimistic. He say everything is so dark and gloomy. So the more I share, the more they are going further away. So how?
You don't focus on the pessimistic. Focus on the positive. Focus on the happiness, the joy of living well, of doing the right thing, of practicing meditation. Buddhism is full of happiness, absolutely packed with it. The problem is that we often sell the wrong thing. We sell Buddhism. We sell all the negative sides. And there's actually happiness everywhere. The whole path is about happiness. Buddhism is about how to be happy. That's the whole point of Buddhism. Yeah, but of course, the way that is presented in the suttas are profound. They are deep. They're not for everyone to understand. And when we present it in the wrong way, people kind of grasp it in the wrong way and they think it is pessimistic. But I think a child is not ready to hear these teachings very often. You should give... Is it to come, I think, at the right age when they are ready and they start to understand what is required and they start to question life and this kind of thing? Maybe that is the right time to become a Buddhist. It's very hard for a child to make these kind of decisions, I think. So I wouldn't. If I were you, I wouldn't worry about it. Just let your children be children, Let them let them do their thing and enjoy themselves and not try to make them into Buddhists because, they... They will have to make that decision at some point down the road. Please, do you have some advice to give? Or here's...
I think that I do find that some of the Jakarta tales are a bit too strong. Mm-hmm. For example, he jumped and allowed himself to be eaten by the tiger, right? So if an adult can't see that, I don't think the child will want to know that, I'm going to feed myself to the tiger. Mm. So I think it's not really that wise sometimes to go through all the Jataka tales with the children.
Mm.
Right. I think having them to come for Sunday school is maybe you should give them some joy. Allow them to play. Creativity, craft, right? More than, I think, sharing the Jataka tales.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah. So, but that's a good point. Maybe there are other ways of doing the Sunday school that are more positive, not so negative. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much input you have in what they do. But, So if your children are saying it is too dark and so, you know, listen to your kids, you know, they have a point. Don't force them too much because then that may be counterproductive. So find that middle way somewhere, you know, try to be wise about this. It's sometimes difficult to be wise, but you have to try your best. So I'm very glad I'm not a parent, I have to admit. Whoa, so hard to be a parent. I got out of that one. Oh, I'm very, very just in time. So, okay, let's carry on a little bit. Now what we're going to do, and this is going to be even more wild, right? Are you ready for something wild?